You're listening to Type Radio. My name is David Berlow. Now we're talking.
Type Radio. Type Radio.
We have the light
version. Oh, you want a light version?
Yeah, a light version.
You're listening to Type Radio. My name is David Berlow. Now we're talking.
And the bold one?
You're listening to Type Radio. My name is David Berlow. Now we're talking.
Type Radio.
You're listening to Type Radio. My name is Donald.
I'm Lisa.
We're at the ATypeHigh Conference 2010 in Dublin, Ireland, and our guest is David Berlow. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here. How do I look?
Fantastic.
Great.
Yeah, your hair is great.
Oh, yeah.
Everything.
Everything. Yeah.
Are you religious?
I'd say I was spiritual. I tend not to think about all the gods that are fighting right now. And so I hope they're all happy together, because there are obviously enough of them for everyone in the world, as long as everybody accepts everybody else's. I just wish that people would pray more than the other things that they do to express their religious beliefs. Praying is like the best religious thing to do. How about you?
It's not your turn to ask questions.
When?
No, not now.
Oh, okay.
Later. You can ask questions. But do you have rituals?
Oh, you mean religious rituals?
Or working rituals?
Oh,
or personal rituals?
Yeah, I'm a totally ritualistic
person. In what way?
Every single day is very tightly scheduled from 6 o'clock in the morning or when the sun comes up, depending on the season. I live entirely by the sun. I have solar rituals that I also have 2 dogs, and they have rituals that I have to keep. So I have a very structured schedule. There isn't a lot of difference between the weekdays and the weekends. Everything just sort of goes on a daily basis. I live very much on a daily ritual.
Are you superstitious?
No.
It's not that if you don't do something in a certain way, then you think something will...
No, the rituals that I have are more related to health and work than to any sort of superstition. I don't believe that if I put on my left sock first and my right sock second, that I'll just work on sans serif today. And if I do it the other way around, I'll do serif. It doesn't work that way. It's always about health and well-being outside of any sort of superstition. I'm not superstitious. I enjoy studying superstition, and I like to talk to superstitious people, because they have these incredibly wild ideas. Like, for example, astrology. I don't really believe in astrology, because it would mean that there were like 650 million people in the world who have the same fortune. And we each have our own fortunes. And no matter how finely you break down, you know, it was the third quarter of the moon when I was born at 2 o'clock, so here's my unique. There are always still tens of thousands of who are totally different from you, who are born at exactly the same time. So I don't believe in that kind of, you know, the stars guide us or anything like that. I think that we're all in control of our own destiny.
So what's the fascination then, if you don't believe it?
What fascination?
Well, with superstition.
Oh, I'm fascinated in talking about it, because I don't have any. And so it's interesting to see what motives bring people to be so superstitious. I know a lot of athletes, and they're very, very superstitious about things, but they only really count the superstitions that work, and if it didn't work, they'll still do it anyways, because...
Well, this sort of reminds me of the Dutch soccer team they came second in the World Championship last year.
I watched.
They had this band with some sort of magnets in it,
yeah.
And they were like, and there was one guy who started wearing these, and then he bought one for all the players.
Yeah.
And every in interviews they were mentioned, and they said like, well, we're not saying they work, but if you know, we never know. You know, like it might help. You never know.
Well, so did the really Spaniards wear one? That's the question.
I mean, I don't know. I don't think so.
If the Dutch wore it all the way through the tournament and then lost the last game, then I guess maybe it was just that they were better than the other teams.
Probably.
That's always been true about Holland. It's just a question of whether the chemistry is there to win.
Yeah.
This year they were just one little chip shot. I was screaming at that guy. Robin? Is that his name? I was screaming, chip it, chip it. Oh!
Yeah.
He made the goalie look like a genius. Anyway.
But the octopus? Did you believe in the octopus that predicted all the games?
I have trouble believing that an octopus... Well, was he conservative or liberal?
Am I conservative?
No, or the octopus.
Was oh, it yeah, I don't
he
know.
He was German, so I...
It was a German octopus.
Yeah.
Oh, huh. And he didn't predict Germany. I don't think he was
German. Yeah, he was right with Germany.
I don't know if octopuses have nationalities.
No, probably not. But he was staying in Germany.
Yeah, he just
residing in Germany.
a German aquarium, so that makes him German.
Yeah, maybe.
But I don't believe in the octopus. I mean,
no. Okay, thank you. That was the Type Radio interview.
Thank you so much.
It was brilliant.
I am so excited that we covered everything that you wanted to talk about.
No, seriously, what is your first... typographic, your memory of type, your first childhood memory of...
I wasn't a very good student, so I didn't spend a lot of time reading or drawing letters when I was a child. I drew people and places and things. I didn't label everything in my drawings. I drew a lot when I was a child, but I didn't label things. And I started getting interested in it actually as I was drawing some athletic figures and sports things, and they have numbers on the jerseys, and I started drawing then. But that's drawing in a sort of an artistic, letters in an artistic context is sort of like for realism as opposed to function of the art. But then one of my roommates in college asked me to do a logo for his company. I didn't realize it until years later, but it was all straight lines. It was ATW for a travel agency he was working with. And I drew the letters, and he was very happy. And then I got into calligraphy as part of requirements of my art education. And when I opened a type drawer, when I was in my first day of typography class, and all those letters were in the little boxes, and I just went... wow, this is like really cool. You don't have to draw everything. You just pick them up and you put them on this composing stick and then you're off to doing it. And it never really occurred to me throughout college, and this was in the early 70s, that people actually designed things, that I was using Herman Zoff's letters or whoever's letters, and that they were actually designed. And it still didn't occur to me until I moved from the Midwest to the United States to New York City. And I started seeing jobs in the paper that had to do with letters and calligraphy and typography and stuff like that. So I went and checked a few of them out. Most of them were not very interesting, like, you know, doing diplomas or, you know, writing things in neat calligraphy. Just didn't appeal to me too terribly much. But then the Linotype Company called me back for an interview, and I went in there and talked to them. And somewhere along the line, they said the word computer. And that sort of clicked in my head as like, no, I could, that sounds not so messy as things, lithography. And, you know, the difficult thing about being a student of typography and letterpress is that there's so much work that goes on to get back to zero after a print run. You've got to take all the letters and sort them back out and clean them up and do all this stuff. And it was just like, wow, that's terrible. I didn't have a Linotype machine, mm-hmm. which did all that stuff for you, that put the letters back and all that stuff. So the computer was an interesting thing because it sort of removed you from the physical trauma of letter use and letter creation. And so I went with that job. I was originally going to do that for 5 years, and then I was going to do photography for 5 years, and then I wanted to go be an art director. But I started meeting art directors in New York, and they weren't very healthy. So I figured that there must be some common problem there, and I recognized that as being pressure from, you know, the desire to do high-quality work and the desire of people to do it cheaper, faster, and different from what you just finished. And I realized that those people were under a kind of pressure that I didn't really appeal to me. So after I was working in type for 10 years, and then I reevaluated, and I said, you know, I still like this. And then after about 12 years, I was ready to found my own company. And I've sort of been very happy with that. ever since.
But is there a difference from when you founded your company to now, when you talk, you know, you talk about the art directors that have this cheaper and faster? Is there, do you see a difference also for you in your company that also there's a...
A cheaper and faster?
Not cheaper and faster, but the pace is faster? Or well, do you say, no,
I think in general, when I first started the company, people didn't have access to custom typography or someone like me ever before. So there was this instant gratification that they got by saying, this is the typeface we want. And then I would go off and prepare it to the best of my ability, which was so much better than anything that they had before. They had nothing to compare to, so they would just take what I did and say, I'm so happy, and be gone. Mm-hmm. And it took about 6 or 7 years before I started running into art directors who had options and were interested in futzing around with things. And then a little later, we had low-resolution technology, screen technology, and all that other stuff coming in. And there are just a lot more variables, and it's much more complicated, and there's a lot more back and forth. But at the same time, not in doing non-custom work, in actually publishing your fonts, and they're out there, that's what they are, people will come and buy them if you put them out there. That whole thing that I sort of started with Eric Speakerman and his font shop thing, they were the first ones to get the fonts that I was selling, and that was sort of like a kind of heaven. Maybe because there was no work involved. I'd already done the work. Here are the products out there, and somebody's going to pay me $50 for the product, and Eric's company's going to get 25 of that, and I'm going to get 25. And then I just made $25, and I was sitting in my living room, and I didn't even know it. So that sort of changed things. And then I got lots more people to work for me, and I have people who take care of the problem, art directors. And they stick around. I mean, our art directors are they're loyal to their font developer. And so, as we all know, they get fired regularly or get tired of the magazine they're working on. They move from magazine to magazine. So we've got this migratory art director scene going on where they go, they come back to us more frequently than just for a redesign of the same magazine. So, you know, I'm now more of a jack of all trades where I can be anything from, I can be the one who acts up and makes trouble on the typographic scene, to somebody who actually zaps the troublemakers who get in the way of any project. So I get to see it from lots of different ends, and so I like that very much.
But well, as a company grows, then you say that you become a jack of all trades. Do you also miss the part of, the making?
I don't miss anything because I don't miss anything. Okay. I mean, when I first started in the industry, I was more of a generalist than the people I was working with. I was working with people who were sign painters who had turned into letter drawers or something closely related. But I have a broad background in geology and history and art history and I've learned a lot about technology, and the majority of my time is still spent designing letters and dealing with either a specific customer or my concept of a group of customers that need a product that I'm working on that they don't have yet. So I'm still doing the same thing that I did. It's just that because technology and the tools have gotten so much better, I can do that more quickly now, and I have time to browse the internet and read things and bring those things back to my company, interact with the people who are doing specific things like marketing or sales or something like that. And they're all really good at their jobs, so I don't really have to get into the nitty-gritty of it unless we're planning something new, and then there's a lot of chaos and friction among the various jacks who are working on various things, and it's pretty interesting. I love getting up every morning, as I said in the religious part of the interview, where I get up with the sun because I just can't wait to see what's going to happen next every single day. And if nothing happens, then there I am drawing my letters, which is pretty happy.
And when you start something new, how is the start? I mean, do you say, I have this idea, or somebody says, I have this idea? How do you...
Well, it really doesn't matter who has the idea, but you think that you have the idea, but you don't. Somebody else sort of had it, and you've been talking to them for so long, and then mm-hmm. suddenly it soaks into your head, and you think that it's your idea. But most of the time, I'm taking things from other people, the Font Bureau, and my job in particular is to listen a lot, and then figure out what they're actually saying, because very few people in the graphic arts or the graphic design industry really know the details of what it is they're thinking that they need. Mm-hmm. So they say, I need a sans serif, low contrast face that works at small sizes. And that says a million things to me. But it's really, that's the end of their understanding of the problem, is what they just told me. So then I have to take that and look at what they were doing before and absorb some of the pieces that were important to them from before, and then add my knowledge of what it was that they actually asked for and turn that into a typeface. So I rarely, if ever, just wake up in the morning and say, oh, I'm going to design a new typeface. Most of the time it's ruminations that go on mm-hmm. for weeks or months, and I solve a glyph, and then it all sort of flows from there. And sometimes I see them in my, as I'm falling asleep, I see the green tracing of a letter.
No, so, really?
It happens.
Does that disturb you sometimes?
Well, the first time it happened, it disturbed me. That it's green, it didn't disturb me, because
no,
I worked for about 6 years with a computer, a very old computer, that you would push the button and it would draw the letter for you, connecting all the dots, and it was green, on a green background, and you'd watch it go, and then you decide whether it was the right thing happened. So that was the first computer I had, and so my brain is sort of attaching itself to the most primitive computer that it can think of, that it's my brain can relate mm-hmm. to, and that's how I dream about letters. Sort of connecting the stars and the sky yeah. is sort of where the other place that it comes from, which is much more natural. And I do that a lot. I watch the stars.
How have you built your stable of designers? How's that come about?
Sort of, it's sort of like being there, and then they, if you're there, then they will come. I didn't even ever think I was going to hire anybody, because my models were people like Matthew Carter and Adrian Frutiger and Herman Zopp, who maybe have an assistant somewhere along the line. But those were my models. And then it sort of turned out that just by doing what I was doing, people who were coming up, and there was a generation gap too. There was sort of like, there were the older guys that were older than me, and there was me, and then there was like this, who's next? And in the late 80s, I couldn't figure out who was going to be next. But then the photographer came out, and the tools became available to all sorts of people, and then people started finding. So a friend of my sister-in-law's was looking for a job. She worked at the Museum of Science in Boston, and her job was to take care of orphan foxes. And she got tired of that job, and my sister-in-law had asked me if I was looking for anyone. And I said, I don't know, but come on. And she didn't have any type experience. She didn't have any photographer experience. I have no idea why I hired her. But she turned out to be, like, this is Jill Pachata. She turned out to be extraordinarily precise and detail-oriented and has taken over the quality assurance and testing for the company and designs a few fonts every once in a while. The next person who came in the door was Tobias Freer-Jones, who had fontographer experience, and he had been designing typefaces since he was 13 years old. And I started throwing projects over my shoulder to him, and then Eric von Blockland and Jos van Roosem showed up as they graduated from college. They had heard that Tobias was there, and they knew that there was somebody in the real world who would teach them something, and so they came, and it just sort of snowballed like that until the next generation, like Tobias was interviewing and hiring people, and I wasn't doing so much. It's been a very organic process. We make this kind of font, and we work this kind of way, and people who like that come and find us. Mm-hmm. You asked the question.
And what drives the decision to sort of redesign or extend a family? Like, is that also coming from the practice of art directors?
It's coming from the public, from people who say, geez, I really like this typeface, but I need something that's wider and bolder, or works at 6-point, or works, you know. And so that's really the biggest selling point that you have as a foundry, is you have these designs out there that really only the styles that you publish are a minority of the styles that are possible. And just because of the way the technology works, instead of having like a tweening process where the art director gets to move some sliders around and find the font they want, we have discrete sizes of fonts, or discrete styles, individual files. And so that's just the way it works. We make as many as are necessary. Sometimes that's difficult for users because you end up with 40 or 50, or Lucas de Groot has even bigger families than that, and just naming them and keeping them straight for users. Thank God most users only use a subset of those big families, and so they end up with 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 of them installed on the machine instead of 40.
Can I ask a question? Sorry. No, in a...
You just did.
No, can I ask a question now?
That's another one.
Oh, okay. I've heard that one before.
You must have. You're in the radio business. Yeah.
No, we were reading a few of your interviews, and at some point they said that you are not an easy person to work with. Is that true? Well, I mean, do you think that, or is that just...
Well, now I'm going to cry.
You're going to cry? Great.
I'm very sensitive. I don't think that there's anyone at work who would say that I'm not an easy person to work with. I'm not an easy person to gain random access to. In other words, for about 12 years, I had an open door. And when I was working for other companies, I was at the beck and call of marketing and technology and business and the type design people. So I had an open door, and people would come and go. And I didn't have any long-term projects going on so that I could be interrupted at any time. When I made my own company, it became a different situation where the company would only rise as fast as I could design. And so designing requires massive quantities of being sealed. So one thing that people have trouble with is that, darling, leave me alone. Happens. No, I can't. I can't talk right now. And I don't answer the phone. Never. I haven't answered the phone for 10 years. Basically, like, I can't have that random thing. And I can see if my mom calls, maybe. I answer the phone. But more or less, I stack everything up, and I take it in order. The ritual I talked about before doesn't want to get disturbed on most days. And so that's one aspect of making it difficult to work with me in some cases. And the other thing is, I'm not somebody who looks at all the good stuff and then spends most of their time telling people all the stuff that they did right. In type design, you assume that people are doing most of the stuff right, and I'll look at all the right stuff and say, right, in my head. I go, what's that? That doesn't work. Get that thing out of here. Fix that. So it's taken me a while just because of a time thing. I don't want to spend a lot of time. So I've learned now over... It took me 25 years to get this. But the first thing you have to say is, this is just fantastic. You have really hit the nail on it. Really build up the person's understanding that you do like it, because I wouldn't be commenting on it at all if I didn't like it. Right? Mm-hmm. And I usually say that very thing. You know, I'm only telling you this because I really like the face. Now, you've got to fix this and that and this and that. So 15 years ago, I was harder to work with than I am now.
Do you ever doubt? Do you think, look back and say, oh, maybe I made a wrong decision like that? Or you're always...
A wrong decision as in not publishing something or yelling at somebody?
Not yelling, but when you say, you look at...
I don't think I was so harsh on anybody that they ran away and didn't come back. So I have nothing to regret there. I mean, I'm not that... I don't make people cry. When I was teaching, I did. Because the person was obviously not doing the work. We're faking it and bringing it in. I said, you're faking it and bringing it in. And then he started crying. I said, oh my God, I can't treat students. You can't. And this is part of learning. I started teaching about 5 or 6 years ago. And this is part of the learning process of being a good manager, is learning how to teach. Because when you're teaching students, they're not like necessarily going to be professional type designers ever in their lives. So you don't want to, you don't want to hurt them too badly. And I was terribly hurt as a student. I mean, I had a calligraphy teacher come out and saw that I was left-handed and gave me a gun and said, use this instead, you'll do better calligraphy. As in, shoot yourself. You know, I mean, can you imagine that? And this is a required course. So I understand what it's like, and yeah. I've sort of grown up a little bit.
Did your left-handedness bother you in your calligraphy? In your
Yeah, it was terrible. It was a terrible thing. In fact, in order to get through that class, I switched. I switched to being right-handed. And I've done other things right-handed before, so it's not... You know,
so you know you're bidexter?
Multidexterous. I don't do things equally with both hands. But calligraphy was something that I just wanted to try because it was so awkward left-handed. And then eventually I learned to do it back. I'd do it backwards left-handed on stone so that when you printed it, it would come out right. And that really, because the right-handed thing eventually gave me sort of a headache. I was getting weird and it really threw me for a loop, this professor who insisted on right-handed calligraphy. So now I work left-handed. Well, that was one of the other things about the computer is that it doesn't care what side you use. So that was important to me.
Do you reject a lot of proposals for new typefaces?
I don't because I've trained somebody else to do it first. We were getting in the mid-90s, when the late 90s, when thousands and thousands of people had taken to the type design tools, we're getting hundreds and hundreds of submissions per quarter. And we would have an offsite. We would get this really thick book that we would be going through, and 85 to 90% of them would be close to something that we'd seen before or just not well done. And so Jill Pichotta, who I mentioned before, learned how to screen those things and what the right things to say to people were, down to a very small number of typefaces that I probably only look at maybe 30 or 40 a year now. And most of them, probably 80% of those, we accept because they've already been through the screening process. And every once in a while, they throw in one from a famous designer or somebody who works in the studio. And mine, we've thrown mine in there. Who did this? And it's good because you get genuine reactions to stuff. And it's difficult to get genuine reactions sometimes, because people are so trained, as I said, to be nice and politically correct and all that stuff to whoever they're dealing with. And so people don't get an honest opinion quite frequently. And I'm much more interested in an honest opinion than you know, not hurting somebody's feelings, especially in a professional. I mean, if somebody's a professional type designer, they ought to be able to take some criticism, you know? Because who else is going to do it?
Who criticizes you the most at work, then?
I wouldn't say that there was somebody who criticized me the most.
But do you get criticism?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. My fonts go through the same process that everybody else's goes through.
Okay.
They're not always anonymous, but sometimes they are anonymous. And so I'll listen to the criticism, talk to them, and ask questions about, well, what makes you think that that wasn't what you know a good thing? And you know, so there's a lot of this going on. And I take a lot of criticism from the outside, and I take criticism from clients. And I deal with criticism pretty well.
Okay, you pass. No.
What are sort of the future of type design sounds so preposterous anyway. Do you see trends? What is like coming trends in type design?
Well, the one that's going to go on and continue forever, I think, is that the technology and the tools and the processes are propagating out from, this may seem sort of Western-centric, but from Europe and North America following the PostScript Revolution. And the PostScript Revolution, I think, was significantly more impactful on political and social events than people think, because the press got to be so cheap. Process of making documents via PostScript and the Macintosh went from being an extremely expensive and exclusive club of publishers to just about anyone. So, for example, in the 90s and early part of this century, we did a lot of work in Central and South America where political systems were changing dramatically, and PostScript was following into the vacuum that was left behind by big publishers, one newspaper companies, countries, politically controlled publishing was very, very heavy. And so the first thing that happened was that all these people wanted to publish. You know, Mexico went from like two dailies to hundreds of dailies mm-hmm. in a matter of a couple of years. And it's still going on. Magazines. And then the next thing that happened was that type designers in those countries said, why are we letting all the gringos get the work? And we've been working with a lot of type designers, particularly in Brazil and Mexico, but all over South America, to first criticize their work and talk about their work and understand where they're coming from, which is very different from North America and Europe, and then watch them go off and make their own companies and do their own thing and make their own businesses and start their own styles, and that's a very exciting thing. So that trend, I think, has a ways more to go. I think that there's a lot of Arabic type design that started up because of the tools and the technology is advancing to the point where you can do more good stuff in that language. We've seen Cyrillic sort of grow up after the change in Russia. The government actually has commissioned and got jobs from Paratype.
So can you say that like this sort of there's a height in type designs after sort of a freedom in publication, like
Yeah, but first there was this freedom of publication, and then the fonts that Adobe and Monotype and Linotype, which have long been sort of have colonized the rest of the world in a way, followed out with the PostScript thing, and then all these cultures said, we don't want these fonts anymore. They've had these fonts since the 50s, mm-hmm. and so they've decided that they're designing their own cultural style, which is getting back. I mean, when I first started traveling in Europe in the 70s, I knew what country I was in because of the fonts and the graphic design that I was seeing. France was different from Holland, was different from Germany, was different. All those countries were different. They were all different from the United States. And then there was this period where they all started to look the same, and only at the top end of graphic design did you have local stuff going on. And now this is changing again, so that you're seeing these culturally specific font things going on outside of Western Europe and the United States. And now that's coming back, and people are saying, hey, you know, what's an LA font? You know, or you know, what's the difference between a Hamburg font and a Bavarian font? No, this is all
it has to do with it, like sort of rediscovering your cultural identity.
Rediscovering cultural identities in a world that's gone global, basically. And I think this is critically important for people to grab onto. So that's the main trend that I see. And that's cultural, and then there's a technical trend that ain't so happy.
but is that in Europe, for example? In the Northern Europe, for example, there's two schools that you could study in, one in Reading or you go to The Hague. You're limited, in a sense, because you're picking up from that school of training. So then to go back into your
own culture
becomes much, much harder.
Well, maybe. I think it depends on how strongly influenced you are by the culture internally.
Yeah.
If you are, for example, a Venezuelan or a Colombian student and you go to Reading, hopefully what you're going to learn is how to do it, not what to do. Mm-hmm. And the what to do stays inside of you. Mm-hmm. And then when you're through learning the first few years, I mean, you never stop learning how to do it, you go home and you apply that to what you're going to do. So I don't see any danger there. I mean, I've worked with a lot of designers of different nationalities that I've never, ever got involved in what they do, what styles. It doesn't really affect me. And when I was a teacher, I don't look at somebody, you know, I had one student 2 years ago who wanted to make a font that was all carrots. And, you know, as silly as that may seem, to make a font out of carrots, it's none of my business. Mm-hmm. What I want to do is make sure that they're good carrots and that the letters that he's making and that he has a process that is going to help him finish that project, do that project. So that's more, I think that that there's a way that the tools and the education could form what you do. And I think that those people generally don't stick around. You don't hear about them very much. But the people who pick up the tools and figure out how it works so that they can do what they do better, those people come up and you find them.
No, when you say, okay, we should preserve our cultural, accentuate these differences.
Yeah.
It's also within education. I mean, we are in Holland, it's quite privileged that they have a school like this, but it's not always possible, for example, and maybe in Venezuela, to have a school.
Yeah. It also might have to do with the fact that, like what you just said, like they're still in that process of learning. The, how to do it.
Yeah.
And that makes it sort of that you see more the stamp of the school in their work, and they have to sort of redefine their cultural identity afterwards. Yeah. And that process starts as soon as they get out.
Yeah.
So,
and it's also clients make you do things and stretch you out. So school doesn't necessarily do that. I mean, when you have, when you're a student, if you're not given the assignment, you have to come up with an assignment. And in typography, assignments, as far as I'm concerned, come always from need. Somebody wants to have something for a particular need. And so as you get pushed more and more, you develop your reaction to the requirements of somebody is your style, and you start to do that. Now, some people just don't have any. You know, they go through school, and they don't know that they don't really have any style until they get out, and clients say, no, I'm not interested in that. And then they have to invent something. And they can't invent far enough to get to the client, and then maybe that's not the right client for them, or maybe they're not the right person for the job. I mean, there's nothing in your genes or your DNA or your fingerprints or anything that says that you're actually going to be good at that. So, I mean, it's you know, it's no different from any other art in the fact that you have to have confidence in your work and execute it well, do the how parts really well, so that the client can see through and say, that's what I want or that's not what I want. So it's complicated with typography because everybody, you know, because it's something that everybody expects people to recognize, the fonts, the use of the fonts. It's something that people, that has to be part of the culture that doesn't stick out. But it gives that piece of culture, that right feeling. And so it's a weird job, I'll admit it. But somebody's got to do it.
Last question. How would you like to be remembered?
Probably through the company, the style of the Font Bureau, the way that it works. More important to me than me individually. So I'm looking for a company that is multi-generation, and it's moved. It's moved in that direction since the beginning. That it's not called the Burlo, the Font Burlo, like that. It's called the Font Bureau. And I've also never named a typeface after myself. These are two things that I don't really care what other people do, but for my particular style, it's always a group effort, and the fonts are always named after something that's appropriate to either the client or the font. So being remembered to me is just that the company goes on and continues to do those. Actually, it's multiple companies now. It's the Font Bureau and WebType and Ready Media and all these things that we put together to help make design easier for people is like the main thing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Type Ready.